This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
It shouldn't be controversial to say you want to protect your ridership, to question letting masked unidentified kidnappers onto your bus. Everyone should be able to move around this city in safety and with dignity.
Protesters rally at the Los Angeles Metro in defense of Sean and Jaime, two drivers who were fired for saying they would not allow ICE to board their buses.
Recently, what happened is a sort of perfect storm for the Milei government.
Argentina's president, Javier Milei, suffers a crushing electoral defeat after the Argentinian parliament overturns a veto of bills to increase funding to education and health care.
The point of this insurrection in Brazil was there was a strategy behind it that was uncovered by the federal police, which is that they were trying to force Lula's hand to declare a state of emergency.
Longtime Brazil-based journalist Brian Meir discusses the recent conviction and sentencing of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro for an attempted coup d'etat after his failed re-election campaign in 2022.
And I begin to see that the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck.
Assata Shakur, revolutionary political activist and member of the Black Liberation Army, has transitioned at the age of 78 in Havana, Cuba. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Protesters rallied at the Los Angeles Metro on September 26th in defense of two drivers, Sean and Jaime, who were fired for saying that they would not allow ICE to board their buses. Pacifica contributor Peter Ross reports from Los Angeles.
On Thursday, September 25th, dozens of transit workers, union members, and community supporters gathered outside LA Metro headquarters to demand justice for two bus operators, Sean Broadbent and Jaime Colato Rodriguez. The drivers were fired in August after publicly saying they would refuse to let ICE agents board their buses, a stance they say was meant to protect passengers. After public outcry and widespread support from workers and community members, Metro reinstated the pair, but without back pay and with a 60-day unpaid suspension still on their records. Supporters say this amounts to retaliation for speaking out, and are demanding that Metro fully clear the drivers and adopt a formal plan to keep riders safe from ICE's anti-immigrant raids.
I am a bus operator from Division 13 across the street. I am honored to be joined by my union siblings, the mechanics, the workers of Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1277. And the bike share workers of Transport Workers Union Local 320. Whether by bike, bus, or rail, we move, LA. And don't get it twisted. Whatever they may say about us, we're here because of love. We have love in our hearts for each other. We have love in our hearts for our community. That is why we are here. I was recently terminated in August. My last paycheck, with 127 hours on it, has still been withheld from me. I was terminated for comments I made on my day off, out of uniform, to LA Public Press, indicating that I would not open the doors for the warrantless, masked raids that have become infamous in our city. My division director labeled my comments egregious and terminated me. Kidnapping is egregious. Imprisoning people who have never committed a crime is egregious. But speaking out on a matter of public concern, according to 1968 Supreme Court in Pickering versus Earl Board of Education, a constitutional right. Maybe not so today. My union has appealed to the third level. We will continue to fight for reinstatement with a clean record and full back pay. We will also continue to fight for a proactive safety policy on ICE, barring action from our employer to ensure the safety of ourselves and our ridership. We will initiate a training for our union to hold for our members. We need a plan.
I think there is power here. The real way to change this, the real way to have some kind of proactive policy is from the union. The union taking a stand saying, we will not allow ICE on our bus, and we stand behind any operator that does so. Remember, Sean and Jaime, how this all started? They got 30 people or so, 30 operators or so together, and they said, we aren't going to let ICE on this bus. That kind of collective action, that is what Metro is afraid of. That is what management is afraid of. We make the wealth of this society, we can stop it. That's the power right there.
And my name's Joe Wagner. I'm a proud member of ATU Local 1277. Unfortunately, my union local is not here speaking on their own behalf, so I'm speaking as a member of ATU Local 1277, as are other members of Local 1277. We have members of the Inland Boatmen Union here. We have Local 99 SEIU in the house. Obviously, the bulk of the people here are from SMART, Local 1607 and other locals. We have a steel worker in the house. We have other unions in the house. This is a United Front protest defending Sean and Hyman. Valiant bus drivers who vowed to protect their community. Hear, hear for Sean and Hyman. An injury to one is an injury to all.
An injury to one is an injury to all.
An injury to one is an injury to all. We also have bike share workers from TWU Local 320. And others. This is an exercise of union power. Yeah. We make the system run. We make Los Angeles run. We make the world run. Workers should run the world. With friends like the Democratic Party who fired Sean and Jaime, who needs enemies? Working people need their own political party, obviously. Why don't we have our own workers' party? Because the trade union bureaucracy ties us to the class enemy through the Democratic Party, generally. We're here to say, rehire Sean and Jaime without any discipline and full back pay. Without playing around. We don't take for any, you know, good words, nice little statements by, at least I don't, from Democratic Party politicians who are in the minority on the board who say, oh yeah, these are the type of operators that we need here at Metro. We know that. We're proud of these bus drivers. Yeah. These bus operators and train operators, mechanics and others who oppose ICE on the platforms. I volunteer with the Volunteer Immigrant Defense Committee in my union, but I'm not even speaking on their behalf. I'm speaking as a member off the clock. So thank you all for being here. Power to the union movement. I think we should give a special shout out to the Italian workers. The Italian workers have made a mass protest in all of Italy to defend the flotilla, bringing aid to the starving people with this genocide in Gaza.
Hey, I'm Anne Marie. I'm with the Bike Share Union, TWU Local 320. I'm very happy to be here. I'm proud to be able to support these bus operators and stand in solidarity with them. What they've done here is powerful. They spoke up even though it was risky. They spoke up because it was the right thing to do. Riders should have assurance that they will be safe on public transit. Metro has not been clear on their protocols for protecting riders from these masked kidnappers. So these operators went ahead and made it clear. We stand with Sean and Jaime. They serve the people. They stood up and they did what's right. It shouldn't be controversial to say you want to protect your ridership, to question letting masked unidentified kidnappers onto your bus. Everyone should be able to move around this city in safety and with dignity, and should not have to fear being disappeared from their communities, especially those folks who built this city and keep it running. Speaking up can be scary because there are consequences, but there's also consequences to not speaking up, not challenging the status quo, not questioning policies that put people in danger. It's a huge risk these bus operators took, and that makes it all the more admirable. I'm happy that they were reinstated, but obviously we demand more. This should be a precedent. We don't want anyone else getting punished for speaking up. No one should fear losing their livelihoods for defending their communities. Lastly, I want to say thank you to Sean and Jaime for making it clear that the safety of your ridership comes first.
So I'm Gary Holloway with the USW down in Carson. We are the local of oil workers, paper workers, and carroceros. So I'm here because Jaime and Sean did something amazing. And we, not just are we negative, we have to be positive. They did something amazing. Every one of us raised in this country saw movie after movie after movie of showing police stays and police raiding places, and every one of us said that when that happens here, we won't help the cops raid places. We won't help a secret police. They won't. They've said so. And for that, they attempted to take their jobs. For that, that act of solidarity with their co-workers, with the community, and with the people, that's been reduced to a suspension. It shouldn't be any discipline, not even a verbal warning. This needs to be clear. We have a secret police raided, running around this country, masked, not accountable to anyone. Either we stop them or they'll get us. So these brothers stood up. We need to stand with them. We're here for justice.
Sean and Jaime are heroes for wanting to defend their bus riders against ICE thugs. They should not be punished by withholding 60 days pay and benefits. Every day there are fresh attacks on workers, ICE raids kidnapping people here and around the country, over 200,000 federal workers fired, criminalizing free speech, attacks on leftist organizations, on and on. These attacks and Sean's and Jaime's case point to the urgency of strengthening the unions as the frontline defense for both their members and workers under the gun, like immigrants. The Metro bosses certainly are not going to defend immigrants. Metro doesn't care about its workforce, let alone immigrants. The vendetta against Sean and Jaime must be stopped in its tracks. It's a threat over the heads of any worker who speaks out or attempts to enforce safety in the workplace. Democratic-run Metro sent a signal to Trump that they won't stand in ICE's way. Appeals to them will only fall on deaf ears. The Democrats are obviously not going to defend immigrants. While ICE has rampaged throughout the county, Mayor Bass's LAPD hospitalized and arrested anti-ICE protesters and members of the press. The Democrats declare LA a sanctuary city to defend their ability to brutally exploit the undocumented. Sean and Jaime showed their fellow union members a stand against ICE. The full weight of the union must be thrown behind the defense of immigrants. But union leaderships that look for friends among the bosses and capitalist politicians refuse to do so.
My name is Promise Lee, and I am here because I am an immigrant, because I am a union member as well, because I am a socialist. What Sean and Jaime did was simply exercise their labor rights to operate their buses in ways they believe will protect their passengers. Instead, Metro's protocol was clear. As Sean puts it, either comply with ICE or lose your job and starve. What Sean and Jaime showed with their instincts and actions is that our laws and contracts are not enough to protect us. An organizer from Unión de Barrio once said that in these times, knowing our rights is not enough. We must defend them. I add that we must fight to expand these rights as well. If not, the people in charge will expand their rights over us at our expense. So I join others to call on Metro to fully drop the charges against Sean and Jaime and also address the real problem, the glaring gap in their policies that only Sean and Jaime's actions brought to light. Metro needs more preemptive safety protocols to secure drivers and passengers against ICE. Get ICE out of our buses. When we win these protections, and I know we can, remember that it is thanks to workers like Sean and Jaime that made it possible to shake up the law and these policies. It is the power of workers taking ownership of laws and contracts for ourselves to push for more when it is not enough in our next union contract, in the next city council meeting, and on the streets. That is the best bulwark against fascism.
That was Pacifica's Peter Ross reporting from a rally at the LA Metro in defense of two drivers fired for saying they would not allow ICE to board their buses.
Yo cruzaré
That was La Bamba Rebelde by Las Cafeteras. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Last week, Trump's ally and Argentina's president, Javier Milei, suffered a crushing electoral defeat when the Argentinian parliament overturned his veto of bills to increase funding to education and health care. This led to a panic in the Argentine stock market. Trump and his Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, have announced they will give Milei a $20 billion loan to prop up his government before the elections in October. University of Buenos Aires professor and Argentine Workers' Party member Guillermo Cain talked with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the electoral defeat and whether Milei can recover.
Recently, what happened is a sort of perfect storm for the Milei government. It suffered an electoral defeat in a local election in the province of Buenos Aires in early September. Many of the bourgeois opposition who had been very collaborationist with the Milei government in the parliament, since they did not reach electoral agreements with Milei, and he insisted on running his own ballot in many of the provinces against local governors who had been collaborationists with his government. The parliament shifted against him on many topics. And these popular struggles and some others gained vast popularity. Another one, for example, is that of handicapped people whose subsidies and the state funds to have professional accompaniment and treatment have also been cut, rendering it impossible for them to attend to the different situations of disabled or handicapped population. So they've also been doing very important demonstrations, like also the pensioners, both going up against the police repression. So this has touched a very sensitive point with thousands of people. So you had these struggles, the parliamentary defeat of Milei, and the electoral defeat, and in parliament, several laws which translated at least partially these demands were passed. So a law rising the university budgets and wages, a law rising the pediatric hospital wages and budget, and laws in favor of handicapped people and pensioners. Milei vetoed these laws, and unlike last year in similar situations, the parliament overturned these vetoes. So last week we had a situation where 200,000 people were demonstrating here in Buenos Aires around the Congress, the National Parliament, when the vetoes regarding the pediatric hospital and the university were overturned, saying it's a legal necessity or obligation, actually, for the federal government to make these wage increases. What's going on now?
Well, I saw the video of the rallies. Yeah. It was on live channel 5, I think, and it was amazing. I mean, the whole parliament, they had a big screen up in front. All these workers from throughout the country had come to Buenos Aires to demand that this law be passed, overturning Milei's veto of it. It was quite a bringing together of workers who were angry. And following that, it seemed like there was tremendous spirit that they beat
Milei. Oh, yeah. It was that day. It felt like a big victory on the streets. Actually, Steve, I have to tell you, those 200,000 people were basically from the Buenos Aires area, and there were important demonstrations throughout the country. So it's not a national demonstration. It would have been much bigger. That was a very important feeling of a coming together. And it wasn't just the university workers. There were a lot of unions. A lot of unions of different sectors, of workers of the private sectors and so on. Also the student movement was present. And in general, different sectors of workers in opposition to the government coming together. So that was very important.
And the Peronist Party apparently has now captured more votes taken away from Milei's support, as well as the left in Argentina?
Yeah. They won in the province of Buenos Aires, by a much larger percentage than was expected. Milei, who absorbed the other right-wing party, the Macri's party PRO, lost millions of votes in regards to the second round of presidential election 2 years ago. Millions of votes. A lot of those votes probably abstained or stayed home. Some might have gone over to Peronism. And the left grew in regards to the last elections at that local election. So now there will be national parliamentary elections in October. We'll see how that comes out. It says a month to go for these general national elections. But some surveys are talking about interesting votes, an interesting amount of votes for the left, possibly voting in several new national congressmen of the Left Unity Front, which, in our case, in the Workers' Party, we're playing a big role also in these conflicts. So we will, of course, use these new parliamentary spaces, if won, to agitate for the class struggle and for the demands and for a political solution for the deep crisis our country is in. No, but some of these surveys are saying between 10 and 14% of vote for the left in the city of Buenos Aires, which will be very important, and between 6, 7, or 7 in the province of Buenos Aires. We'll see if this, becomes a reality. In the recent election in the province of Buenos Aires, the general average of vote for the left was between 4 and 5%, but in some cities, like La Matanza, a very important working class district with 2 million inhabitants, and near the city of Buenos Aires, we were close to 8% of the vote. So I think it was an important election for the left. This expresses, a combative spirit in a sector of the working class. And the other thing I want to tell you, Steve, and I'm sure you've seen this in recent news, is the economy is the other big crisis here. Milei's economic scheme just cannot be maintained. There's a strong pressure, even from sectors of the local bourgeoisie, to devaluate the peso. And he has already spent all of the dollars, the millions of dollars from the IMF,
propping up the currency. Wasn't there a run after that election?
Yeah, that's what happened. So he spent all of the money that the IMF had given him about 3 months ago, and the peso went from 1,300 and something to 1,500 in a week. And now it's gone down a bit because Trump and Bessent have said that they will give the Milei government all the dollars it wants. There's no clarity to what the conditions that the Trump administration is demanding, be they in terms of military support, in terms of control of natural resources, or other sorts of conditions that we've clearly seen Trump put on the table when intervening in other conflicts or situations. So, not just the revolutionary left, but even bourgeois opposition or mass media are commenting that Milei, to try to not devalue it before these elections in October and try not to be defeated or to have that big an electoral defeat, is condemning us to some form of renewed colonial oppression, the characteristics of which are still not clear, but which are at the center of this agreement with Trump that has been at the top of not only Argentine media, but internationally, that the Milei government is going downhill fast and Trump is, is agreeing a big spending bill to try to prop him up. My feeling as a militant and that of many here is that we have suffered through the worst of the very concentrated attack by the state and the bosses to try to crush working class organization, and that they, an opportunity is starting to open up with the political crisis of the Milei regime, and which we'll be able to start organizing a strike back. But even in the moments of very intense attack by the government, we've had strikes and mobilizations of up to 1 million people, which I think expresses a level of organization, of opposition to the government, and of working class independent organization, which is strong. you know, in relative terms. Yesterday night, I was up till 1 a.m. With the comrades of the Sutna, of the tire workers union, who in a year where they've had very tough conflicts with hundreds of layoffs, occupying factories, striking factories, making pickets, but under very difficult conditions, they haven't been able to resist all the level of attacks by the bosses. So the trade union bureaucracy and the companies were financing many opposition ballots in the union to try to push the class struggle leadership linked to the PO out of the union. And I want to tell you that with over 46% of the vote last night, our comrade Alejandro Crespo was again voted as the equivalent of president of the tire workers union, which is the main industrial union led by the left in Argentina. So, you know, they've definitely been trying to use the Milei moment as an international media darling, the support of imperialism and big companies to destroy leftist organization in the unions and the working class. But we're happy to say they are not succeeding. 2 months ago, we did a national meeting of 1,000 leaders of unions, unemployed workers movement and pensioners, which voted a common plan of action, which has been an important part of the reaction against the Milei government, his vetoes on working class demands in Congress, and his attacks on the public services. And it's playing an important part in calling on demonstrations of thousands of workers, coordinating radical and left forces in the labor movement. So that's a bit of what we're doing, and I think the importance it has in the struggles that are upcoming in Argentina.
That was Buenos Aires professor Guillermo Kane of the Argentine Workers' Party discussing President Javier Milei's parliamentary setback and what this means to Argentina's working class.
Que se escuche fuerte y luche muchedumbre de mi tierra. Sus cartuchos son el miedo a un pueblo que nos encierra. Que se aferra a sus derechos adquiridos y que va a recuperar esos laureles que han vendido porque no nos han vencido. Y aunque esté podrido, el gobierno son eternos nuestros desaparecidos. Recortes sin disimulo, mulos del fondo. Camino al hondo, destino del patíbulo. Discípulos de un círculo y sus vínculos un bulo. De espaldas al pueblo, el pueblo les toca el culo. Tanto daño y el gran tamaño de esta sociedad que no tolera ser rebaño. Aunque a veces se equivoca cuando toca lo que es suyo, sale de sus entrañas el Inca y desde el Cuyo el general renace y de vuelta nos aviva. El único sendero es el que nos mostró Bolívar, y ante la suerte esquiva y el pie de los de arriba, los ojos logran ver que la unidad es la salida. A pesar de la mentira y que muchos se disfracen, lo que tienen para el pueblo son balas, palos y gases. Jetones en la tele, buches de los patrones ensucian al pueblo mapuche y sus convicciones, odiando lo propio, venerando lo ajeno, inyectando veneno en su propio seno. Xenofobia a la inversa, un vil trofeo, suicidio tilingo por creerse europeos. La gloria de estas tierras nunca termina.
That was Daniel DeVita, Unidad de los Trabajadores. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Next, YouTube host Jamaro Thomas speaks to longtime journalist and Brazilian resident Brian Meir on the conviction and sentencing of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro and high-level Brazilian military officials for the attempted coup surrounding his close but failed re-election campaign in October 2022. The winner, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was inaugurated for his third term on January 1st, 2023. Brian Meir is a Telesur English contributor who also publishes on Substack at Delinking Brazil.
Bolsonaro, convicted, 27 years in prison. I think it was 27 years, 3 months to be accurate. And he's convicted for effectively trying to overthrow the democratic government of Brazil. And just to read, it says, in 2022 election, in the coup plot that included disbanding courts, empowering military, and assassinating the president, who was at that point Lula da Silva. I was there for that election, by the way, and I had the opportunity to talk to people on the ground. That was an astonishing election. For one, it was done very efficiently. So it was done very early, like 9 o'clock at night. Lula only won by like 51% to 48%. It was very close, much closer than I would have expected. And when I talked to the people on the ground, there were actually some people that believed that Brazil should need it and required a military dictatorship. Now, when you press those people a little bit more, they may waver on that. But some of the people actually believed that. There were protests hanging out at military bases, wanting the military to effectively overthrow the government because Lula won. I'm amazed by that. Give me your take on this, though. First, on Bolsonaro's and his conviction. And two, on the response of the public in this regard.
You know, first of all, Bolsonaro has been proven now in court to have an entire, you know, network of very well-funded operatives spreading disinformation on social media about the electoral process. It was a key strategy of their group, as proven in these three investigations that took place. Their strategy was to spread a false narrative that the electronic voting system was susceptible to hacking. And they spent about 2 years doing this with constant communication, by the way, with people like Steve Bannon in the United States, effectively preemptively building a stop the steal narrative. And he was first punished and disqualified for running for office for 8 years after he abused his power as president by harnessing the National Public Television Network to produce a one-hour live broadcast with over 100 foreign diplomats only a few weeks from the election, in which he lied without providing any evidence whatsoever that the elections were going to be hacked and that the system was susceptible to fraud. Then he ordered the military to do an internal investigation on the susceptibility to fraud of the electronic voting system. And their own investigation, his own military, who he appointed, came up with a result that it was impossible to hack into the system. So then he repressed that study from being released to the public. So we know that a lot of people are victims to this kind of disinformation on social media. It's a huge problem. We see it in London right now, and in the UK with this, the largest fascist march in the history of the UK took place on Saturday. So that's one of the reasons that some people in the public, or a large minority, believed that Brazil should revert to a military dictatorship. But regarding the conviction, it started with a parliamentary investigation that produced a 3,000-page final report suggesting that the federal police investigate. The federal police investigated and came up with a 1,000-page final report based on mountains of material evidence indicting Bolsonaro and 33 of his cronies. Based on that report, the Attorney General's office launched a third investigation, and its final result was a 272-page report indicting Bolsonaro and 31 of his cronies. One person made it out through that report, and that's how the trial started, really, you know? And it was an investigation that was initially called for by the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court in Brazil doesn't have a Supreme Court police. The U.S. Supreme Court has its own police force. It has its own intelligence department. And its primary goal is to investigate threats against Supreme Court justices, right? And this is what was happening in Brazil. Death threats, doxing, and things like that happening on social media. So that's how the investigation into Bolsonaro initially began. Everything that happened is totally within the framework of Brazilian law. Brazil's laws are different than the U.S. laws. Some bad faith actors, including Glenn Greenwald, who's been pushing the same narrative that the Bolsonaros have been pushing about an authoritarian judiciary now for like 2 years. They try to say, oh, well, it's just until 2020, all cases in the Supreme Court dealing with criminal charges were reviewed by panels. There's two panels with five justices each. This was because of the backlog. And so in 2020, they switched it to go up to the full 11-member body of the court. But it created it exacerbated the backlog by so much that in 2023, the Supreme Court unanimously voted to revert to this panel system, including the two appointees by Jair Bolsonaro voted in favor of referring all criminal cases to the panels. And the investigation into Bolsonaro was underway at that point. So there's, I mean, some of the arguments people have been trying to use to delegitimize this process are just based on United States law, but Brazil has different laws, you know?
Yeah.
And yet even comparing the Donald Trump case with the Bolsonaro case is a false equivalency. There's a lot of similarities, but Donald Trump didn't spend 2 years coordinating with military leadership a military coup. I mean, the point of this insurrection or capital riots or whatever you want to call it in Brazil was there was a strategy behind it that was uncovered by the federal police, which is that they were trying to force Lula's hand to declare a state of emergency. And so there were high-level police officers, police commanders cooperating with the rioters, opening the doors to the government buildings for them in the hopes that Lula would declare a state of emergency. If that happened, security of Brazil would have been temporarily turned over to the armed forces. And it was written in a plan that was found, you know, on Bolsonaro's desk, printed on his computer in the presidential palace, that at that moment, the military would then arrest Lula, arrest the Supreme Court ministers, arrest Vice President Geraldo Alckmin, and then announce that they were going to take over governing the country until new elections could be held. Well, that's what they announced in 1964, that they were taking over the country until new elections could be held. And the new elections were only held in 1989. So it was clearly an attempt at a coup. There was a special forces unit that was surveilling Lula, Geraldo Alckmin, and Supreme Court Minister Alexandre de Moraes. And this was called Operation Green and Yellow Fist. Green and yellow are the colors of the flag. And they were planning to assassinate the three of them. That's been uncovered as well. And it's been proven that Bolsonaro knew about this. Wow. So that's very different from what happened with Trump. Okay, Trump should probably have been arrested or put on trial for inciting a riot at the Capitol. But no one's come out with this proof that Trump had been plotting that for 2 years with, you know, former actors from the military dictatorship, like General Augusto Heleno, you know, who was an important figure in the dictatorship that ended in 1985, and also the commander of Minustah's armed forces during the Sitsoleil massacre. I mean, he was in charge of 16 departments in the federal government, including intelligence, and he was one of the people behind this 2 years of coup plotting. So it's a much more serious case in Brazil, and I feel like I see some of the Democratic aligned press, like New York Times and things like that, trying to both sides it and say, oh, look, this is what happened in Brazil. You know, it's just the same thing that Trump did. Well, no, it was a lot worse. I mean, the day of those riots, right, they blew up 17 high-tension electrical towers across the country, creating blackouts in a bunch of different towns to create this kind of feeling of chaos. They also apprehended one of the people who was living in one of these camps in front of the military bases demanding military intervention, trying to transport a bomb to the Brasilia airport on Christmas Day, a bomb attached to a petroleum truck, you know? And so there was also an attempt to storm the federal police headquarters. It was attacked with Molotov cocktails, and they were burning buses and cars a couple weeks before the January 8th insurrection. And also the day that Lula and his wife came to Brasilia for a ceremony in which you receive your official qualifications a couple weeks before taking power, rioters attacked the hotel he was in with Molotov cocktails. And so it was more violent than, as bad as the Trump thing was, just he'd worked his followers up into such a frenzy, he would just basically yell, go, and they all ran towards the the capital or something. But I don't think it was as well planned as what happened in Brazil, because Brazil has a history of military coups. The first military coup took place in 1891. There have been 13 military coup or military coup attempts between 1891 and 2023. And this is the first time in history that any high-ranking member of the Brazilian military has ever been convicted of participating in a coup. You know, and these are big people. It's his former defense minister, General Heleno, who dates back. General Heleno took part in auto coup attempt during the dictatorship, because he was the personal attaché for a general named Silvio Frota, who was like from the hardline fascist group of military leadership that didn't want to return to civilian rule. So he tried to overthrow the government from inside in 78. He was only transferred to a desk job and forced into early retirement. Helena was his personal assistant during that coup attempt, you know? And after the dictatorship ended, they gave amnesty to all of the torturers and all of the people who'd been killing labor union leaders and students and activists and stuff like that. So this is like, it was a historical moment in Brazil last week when we saw five high-ranking members of the armed forces convicted for participating in an attempt to overthrow the government and install a military dictatorship. It's almost bigger news than Bolsonaro's conviction if you look at Brazilian history. I mean, if you look at the history of Brazil's coups, of course there wouldn't have been an election, you know. Mm-hmm. They might have allowed Senate during the dictatorship. They allowed two political parties to exist. I think it reminds me of the United States today with its two parties, because, you know, they symbolically allow other parties to exist, but they don't enable them to win elections or anything. But there were two parties that were allowed to exist. The dictatorship appointed governors, but they had elections for mayor, for senator. The Senate was like two elected senators, one appointed by the dictatorship. They had congressional elections the entire time during the dictatorship. They just said you could only belong to these two right-wing parties. You know, and so I think if the military had taken control, they would have done some kind of, they would have created some kind of scenario in which some elections would have been taking place, but not presidential, you know, at least not for a few years.
Brian, Donald Trump has murdered three more people in the South Caribbean, claiming that they were, quote unquote, narco terrorists. What is the region thinking about this? I mean, the United States seems to be setting up a decapitation strike on Venezuela, and they have all sorts of forces in the region. I can't believe that the region is okay with the U.S. coming back with this kind of Monroe Doctrine.
Obviously, the countries that are completely sycophantic to Trump and the Trump administration, the U.S. government in general, like Javier Milei's Argentina, Ecuador, you know, these countries are applauding it. And the countries, any country that has any level of sovereignty, the people are very upset about it. President Lula has criticized it, even though the relationships between Brazil and Venezuela are at a low point right now. But hopefully the fact that both countries are under attack, Brazil's clearly under some kind of hybrid warfare attack from the U.S. right now, and Venezuela is like physically under attack, this is going to bring them closer together. And I hope they can sort out their differences and unite the way they united in 2004 to defeat George Bush's free trade agreement of the Americas when Hugo Chavez and Lula pushed through that measure, infuriating the Bush administration. So I hope that this pushes Venezuela and Brazil closer together, because these two countries need each other right now. Top level members of the party have said it. Lula said it. You know, all the analysts are saying that Brazil's under hybrid warfare attack from the Trump administration. Right? Regarding the tariffs, they pushed through a $8 billion economic stimulus package for all of the industries that were affected by the tariffs. And China has stepped in and bought up all the coffee that wasn't going to the U.S. And so ironically, Brazil's foreign trade increased to $6.1 billion during the first month of the sanctions. And new employment figures have just been released. And now it's got its lowest unemployment rate since 2012. So economically, Brazil has done a very good job of protecting itself. The big problem are these social media oligarchs targeting the Brazilian left right now, targeting the Workers' Party government. Well, Elon Musk has repeatedly threatened Brazil, and we know the relationship between the oligarchs like Peter Thiel and Elon Musk and the guy from, I don't know, it's Discord or Rumble, I'm confused, with the Trump administration. And so what you see is algorithmic manipulation to constantly bury opinions from leftists on the big social media platforms. There's Zuckerberg too. Sorry, I didn't mention this. Zuckerberg. They're all gunning for Brazil because they don't want to be held liable for Brazilian crimes committed on their platforms. And so Brazil is trying to regulate specifically against pedophiles and people targeting children and adolescents on social media. The social media companies don't want to be held liable for this. They want to be able to apply U.S. regulatory environment in Brazil. Brazil has different laws related to speech. You know, you can't promote Nazism in Brazil. That's a violation. There's no freedom for Nazis. There's no freedom for pedophiles. An organization like NAMBLA would be illegal in Brazil, where it's totally legal in the U.S. Brazil's conception of free speech is that everyone has the right to it. It's a fundamental right, but it can't be used to deny other people's rights.
That was Brian Meir of Telesur English and Delinking Brazil speaking to Jamarl Thomas on September 16th, 2025.
Hoje você é quem manda, falou, tá falado, não tem discussão, não. A minha gente hoje anda falando de lado e olhando pro chão. Viu, você que inventou esse estado, inventou de inventar toda a escuridão. Você que inventou o pecado, esqueceu-se de inventar o perdão.
Apesar de você amanhã de ser outro dia,
eu pergunto a você onde vai se esconder da enorme euforia. Como vai proibir quando o galo insistir em cantar? Água nova brotando e a gente se amando sem parar. Quando chegar o momento, esse meu sofrimento, vou cobrar com juros, juro, todo esse amor reprimido, esse grito contigo.
That was Chico Buarque. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. Next, Assata Shakur, revolutionary political activist and member of the Black Liberation Army, has transitioned at the age of 78 in Havana, Cuba. Pacifica's Fahima Sek pays tribute to her.
Assata Olubala Shakur, born Joanne Deborah Byron on Wednesday, July 16, 1947, in New York City. A Black liberation activist, author, and member of the Black Liberation Army and the Black Panther Party. Transitioned to the realm of the ancestors on Thursday, September 25, 2025, per Cuba's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I won't read you her obituary, but implore you instead to experience Assata in her own words at assatashakur.org, where you'll find articles, interviews, films, and her autobiography, Assata. I pay tribute with a salute to Cuba that allowed her to live as a free revolutionary Black woman in the country that provided her exile since 1984 until the day of her very last breath.
Havana Sky. It was not what I had anticipated. Telltale of Orishas in plain sight, reverenced and revered in institutions of higher learning, museums, art galleries, Universidad, Casa de Don Fernando Ortiz. The sacred is not secret when there is no shame in having an Africana god or goddess who manifests the same temperament of our ancestors and characteristics of our children yet to be born. Havana Sky. Frozen in time without the constraints of a timeline, yet keepers of the history, good or bad, triumphant or sad. Havana Sky. Today we drink Cuba Libre at the Havana Club. But first, ahora, we must pour libations to the grandmothers not here and the many compañeros not here under the Havana sky.
Asada taught us, it is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. I leave you with Asada in her own words. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Fahima Sek.
The whole liberation of oppressed people in the United States has to do not with climbing up some ladder to success, not for asking to be just like Rockefeller or just like DuPont or just like Ford, because that would only continue the oppression and exploitation of oppressed people in the United States, and specifically African people born and raised in the United States. Socialism is an integral part of building social justice on this planet. The condition of my people, my history, was very much connected with other oppressed people, and I began to see that the same foot that was on the necks of the Vietnamese people, that was on the necks of all oppressed people on the planet, was the same foot that was on my neck. And so I began to understand that imperialism has to go. It is a poison that is killing people all over this world. The priorities of this planet have to be completely changed. And instead of profits, instead of policies that destroy the earth, that destroy the water, that destroy human beings, I believe a policy that protects people, that makes people live in a community, a world community. That's what I believe. That's my basic political commitment at this moment.
We'll believe in freedom. Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom. And not rest until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom, and freedom cannot rest. Sing it with me if you like it. We who believe in freedom,
and that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, Fahima Sek, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.